This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we take a tour of Naval Magazine Indian Island with an unlikely group of tourists. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
So if it's in the conventional inventory, it is on this base. So, bombs, missiles, small arms, almost anything you can imagine conventionally is stored here. Yeah.
It was perhaps the most unlikely tour group ever. About a dozen Quakers and like-minded peace activists boarded a beige-painted Bluebird school bus one recent Friday morning to tour Naval Magazine Indian Island, which is commonly believed to be the largest exporter of munitions and armaments on the West Coast, and therefore a target of protest for many years of many of those aboard, hardcore pacifists one and all. Among the tour group, for example, was Neil Lydon, who on most Thursday afternoons sits for hours in silent vigil for peace opposite the entrance to the base, sometimes all by himself. Several longtime members of Ground Zero, the anti-nuclear group which has led opposition to the Trident nuclear submarine program for decades, were also present. I arrived with Kathy Darrow, the cheery retired conservation biologist who had arranged the tour, along with Rachel Sweat and Doran Campbell, who spent much of the drive over from Port Townsend sitting in the back seat exchanging anecdotes about their draft resistance work in the San Francisco Bay Area during the Vietnam War. Darrow, who had taken a previous tour of the island, had passed around a sign-up sheet at the Port Townsend Quaker meeting a couple of months before, making it clear that those who did not sign up well in advance would not be allowed to attend, as naval security would want to carefully vet each name, no doubt with an eye for potential terrorists. And so it was with some nervousness that our group approached the guardhouse at the gate that morning. After presenting all of our driver's licenses, we were directed by guards armed with automatic weapons to enter a tall steel roof structure just behind the gate, where concrete barricades popped up in front and behind us, blocking our exit for the time another guard took to check each of our IDs against a roster in an adjacent glass-fronted cubicle. When at last the barricade in front of us dropped away, we were instructed to drive a short ways ahead to a small parking lot where our bare-bones tour bus awaited us, attended by Indian Island Public Affairs Officer Philip Guerrero, the stern-faced liaison with whom Darrow had worked to organize the tour. In fairly short order, we were joined by the rest of our group in several following cars, and then finally by a vehicle carrying Indian Island Commanding Officer Nicholas A. Vandegrind, who left a post at Naval Air Station Whidbey Island to assume command of the base in June of 2015, and environmental specialist Bill Kalina, who has worked to enhance the natural aspects of the island for more than 2.5 decades. Disarmingly friendly, Vandegrind quickly dispelled any preconceptions the group may have had of the stiff naval commander, shaking hands with each of us in turn with an easy smile and launching right into a breezy outline of the staffing of the base and a key problem it shares with the rest of the Eastern Olympic Peninsula, an acute housing shortage.
Overall, we probably have around 200 employees assigned to Indian Island. That includes contract security and some of the other things. And we additionally have another 125 reserves that we support. Well, they actually support me, but and they'll come out. They'll do their 2 weeks a year here. You probably see them out in the community. They stay in the hotels here and get rental cars, and they live out in town for their 2 weeks. Then Kitsap will come up once a month for their two-day weekend.
Is there housing on the base?
No housing. Used to be originally 400 to 500 military were in on Indian Island. We had barracks. We had food, housing, medical services. We had the barracks for them. We also had officer housing. So how many units?
14.
14 units. And it got so costly to maintain. It was sad because that stuff was all built in the 40s. So it was historical buildings that we couldn't afford to maintain anymore. So they had those things removed.
When was that taken out?
So the last of the housing was removed in 2005. Yeah. And so ever since then, I live in Kelly Point. And so we live wherever we can. The hard part for military up here, and I have 17 active duty guys right now. That'll go to about 22. That's for harbor security and stuff like that. But we're used to living in military towns where there's a big turnover of rentals, things like that. And so like when I moved up here, I knew a year and a half beforehand that I was coming here. So I started pulsing the market and put some things that automatically tell me when something pops, and nothing pops. So it took a long time. Literally 3 weeks before we came, I still didn't have an address. And all of a sudden something popped in Caleb Point, and I was like, I called him and I was like, sight unseen, I'll take it. Whatever you're asking, give me the house. Wow. And so we were able to come. So those are challenges. And with the enlisted guys we're bringing up, some of them are able to find stuff up here. Some of them are out in Squim, a couple of them down in Poolsbo area, but we're just kind of finding what they can. So So the hard part there is who I can bring here. So in the Navy, it's military, right? So the assumption is that I should be able to take some kid straight out of Chemicum High School, and I'm going to care for him for every piece of his needs. I will provide him medical, transportation. He should show up with a sea bag with his clothes in it, and I should be able to take care of him from there. I can't do that here. So I'm very limited on who can come and serve at Indian Island because I don't have all those facilities that we really need to do that sort of thing. So,
hey, why don't we get on the bus, get out of this cold weather?
Yeah. So you mentioned contract security. So the security on the island is actually
so we have
not Navy?
Divided into three pieces. So you have a contract piece, and then we have Department of the Navy police officers, and then we also have active duty. Master at Arms security.
Yeah, you barely room for your legs.
As we started to roll, we soon were passing a series of small turf-covered bunkers with concrete ends and steel doors.
What are these? This thing coming up on our right. What is this?
These are magazines.
These are all original. So these were built in '41, and you'll see the signs on there. It says empty. It's literally empty. There's nothing in there. So we have what's called a PTR. It's a public transit route. So what we, for normal operations, we don't take people in and out of places where the ARC is cached. So if to keep people out of explosive ARCs, to include City, Port Towns, and Barrowstone, our own people have to be protected too. So no administrative buildings can be inside explosive ARCs or our normal routes for getting back and forth. So this area is all completely out of the ARCs.
They vary in size from a small Volkswagen to the size of a basketball court. And you'll see the basketball court size today. So, and those World War II era ones were built when the munitions were much smaller. If you look at the old photographs from World War II, you know, bombs were this size and this size. Now they're half as long as this bus. So, and the weapons just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So the island is 5.5 miles long by a mile wide, 2,700 acres roughly. And of that 2,700 acres, only about 600 is developed. So most of the island is forested, as you'll see. And that's mainly because of the ARCs, you know, just made you. So it keeps, it's kind of like a wildlife refuge, if you will. You know, we protect the forest and keep the habitat on the shoreline and the forest. Because of our mission, it's compatible, so it works great. That's why we have more wildlife probably than any other Navy base in the region.
Yeah. So we have two cougars that live here. One of them was roaming. The guards got a picture of him because he was hanging out at our front gate, walking through our security barriers. Sometimes we get a little closer than we would like.
I hear you've got several breeding pairs of bald eagles on the island?
We have 10 active nest territories. When I first started here, we had 5. They've doubled since I've been here. Yeah. So eagle population is growing, and it's hard for them to find trees that are suitable to build a nest in because the tree has to support the weight of a 2-ton nest. But here on the island, we have some of the, you know, mature trees, large trees, and they're able to do that.
So our last clear cut here was 75 years ago, so our trees are a little older, at least, compared to a lot of other areas, anyway.
Is there any old growth on the island?
No, I don't think there's any old growth left, Bill, do you think?
No, there's a couple trees that they left behind that are old growth age, but for the most part, there's no timber stands. This is all third growth coniferous forest. So this is Crane Point. During World War II, there was a Navy operated its own ferry going from where the lower Hadlock Ajax Cafe is to here. And that would run every half hour. And this was, this area during World War II, the Navy operated its own creosote plant for
for timber. There was rail car facilities, loading docks. So this was a very busy area in World War II. Today it's used when we host exercises like J-LOTS last year with the Army. This was Tent City. This is where they set up their tent camps and run all the operations out of here. This is also where we do our command functions, like command picnic, the deer run, which some of you may have heard of or participated in. That takes place. This is where people come to.
I'm sorry, what is the deer run? I don't know what that is.
The deer run we do every summer, usually in July, and we invite the community to come over, and it's the one public event that I can do on the base. It's a lot of hoops to jump through for security to do something like that, but we bring everybody down here. If you want to register, you're welcome to come. Everybody's welcome to come to the deer run. Last year we had 225 people. I think you'll see documents that say the deer run is geared towards military people. I don't look at it like that at all. So for me, it's a chance to bring the community in, because you guys are the closest thing I have. So if I want to share a moment with somebody, I want to share it with the people in the immediate area. So it's a 5K run and a 1 mile walk. You can run or walk either one of them. We don't care. Preferably you'd finish in less than an hour, but because we limit the time, but yeah, it's a great time to come out and take a walk around the base. It's like the second or third, I think it's the third Saturday of July. Yeah.
So Jefferson Days was the 4th of July event. And then as part of one of the events of the day was to do the deer run. But there were lots of events that were, you know, packed into that day. But after 9/11, we could no longer host the big Jefferson Days event out here.
Yeah, and after 9/11, security became really tight. That's where we changed the entire posture of the island. So even to active duty, so if a guy from, say, Bangor wants to come up here and see the base, and he's wearing this uniform and has a military ID card, you're not allowed on the base. I get plenty of feedback on that from retirees that are in the area because they want to come use the exchange and stuff like that, and I can't do that. So, hey, just before we move on to, I don't know how much history you guys know about the island. So in 39, that's when this was purchased. So it was purchased for $5 million, which included all the buildings, the World War II buildings that you see on here. So drop in the bucket compared to today's dollar, but probably a lot of money back then. So some of the buildings, like down here, that warehouse, that's original. So that was built in 41. It's spectacular on the inside. It's if you go inside that warehouse, it feels like a church to me, just the way the wood and stuff that they used back then. It's phenomenal. The entire floor is made out of blocks of wood that are about 6x6 and about that thick. So, and the original intent was for to keep Puget Sound safe. So it was to prevent Japanese submarines from entering Puget Sound. We built submarine netting out of that building right there. You'll see the floats. You see any here?
You'll see these giant wooden crates. That's what it looks like. Those are actually floats that used to attach these submarine nets onto. They'd be able to pull them out and protect the harbor. Ooh.
So that net had to be pulled aside when our own submarines wanted to pass?
Right. There were gates. They would open. Similar to what we have today, up at the ammunition pier, we have the port security barrier around the ships. When those ships come in, then our port operations group, which works out of that building, and those are their boats there, they have to open the gate, let the ship in, then close the gate behind it.
They must hinder the migration of sea mammals and fish.
Back in the day.
We don't use anything like that anymore.
Yeah,
but no. We have no underwater netting anymore.
Oh,
yeah, it's
okay.
Gone. But you're right. It probably did have an impact back in the day. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You can imagine a giant chain link fence. But to make it big enough so it can go to the bottom, they had to have a really high ceiling. And that's why that building is so high.
So what are those warehouses used for today?
Not explosive material. Yeah. We also have wood. So we use, it's called block and brace material. So when you load a trailer, to maximize the safety, everything has to be blocked and braced in place. And we use wood for that. And some of it's stored in there. Yeah.
Okay, we'll continue down past here and show you some more stuff.
Hey, if you see the orange boxes over there?
Yeah.
So we are a geographical responder. So my guys are trained not just for, if we spill oil off of one of our own ships, we obviously have to take care of that. But we're also a geographical responder for anything that happens in the region. So if somebody comes by one of these tankers and has a problem, my guys will get out there. I have about 2 miles of oily waste boom so we can contain spills and get cleanup started. So we have our own skimmers and stuff like that we can start instantaneously until the big problem, we need a lot more help, but we can contain the spill and start the process right away.
They put the oil containment boom around every ship that comes in, just in case. Building on the right here, this is our sewage treatment plant. So we offer hotel services to the ships, like the ship that's here now. We take their sewage and treat it, and also all the sewage, obviously, from the base. So we're our own city, if you will. This, we just recently added a ultraviolet disinfection system to get rid of the chlorine gas and tablet system. So it's been working out real well for us, but it's sand filtration, secondary treatment, and discharge. So very clean, very good technology that we're producing. Then coming up here on the right will be our fire station. So that's our base fire station. They're federal firefighters, but they do most of their work is done off station with mutual aid calls. So backing up county and city, Jeff County. So, you know, I'd say 95% of their calls are off station.
It works really well, and I love doing the mutual aid, but it does have a mission impact. So the phone call I got 60 seconds ago was to tell me that we've suspended all ordnance operations on the base, specifically so I could get that fire truck out in town and respond to the community. So I love doing that stuff. Other bases, usually the bulk of their work is all on base. So when they respond to fires, it's because housing or something happened on the base. For us, we respond about 170 times per year. 160 of those will be to the local community, not to the base. Very few, and the ones they do respond to on base are usually false alarms, things like that. So we do traffic accidents, fires, anything that's happening out there, we're out there.
We can, we're not getting off at the pier today, we can substitute the Eagle Nest.
And we might be able to roll through the pier at least. Okay. We'll see what we can do.
Oh, great.
Since I had to suspend ops on the pier, we actually might be able to drive through there. So.
Blessing in the sky.
So I imagine the fire department must have, like, you know, some worst case scenarios they have to think about. And
the, you mean as far as like explosive materials,
yeah,
stuff like that?
Yeah, an accident.
So yes, they do get training with explosives to make sure they're able to recognize what sort of material they're dealing with before they engage with the fire. So there's different hazards associated with different types of munitions, so they have to make sure they're aware of that. Yeah.
I'm sure you're aware that one of the concerns that has been abroad in Port Townsend and elsewhere for a long time has been, you know, like, what happens in a worst case accident at Indian Island? How is Port Townsend affected and so on? And there was actually a case that went to the Supreme Court about that.
Yeah, yeah. 2011, I think it was?
Yeah. And then the Navy was, like, so anxious not to reveal what their scenarios were that there was a bill put through Congress saying that the Navy, a bill was passed to specifically exempt the Navy from being able to.
Absolutely, yeah.
So people have been concerned about that. It's like, well, why would the Navy not want that information?
So here's the thing. So if I tell you, if I look at your house and I say, I want to know exactly where the explosives are in your house. So if you ask you to draw me a diagram and you show me everything that's explosive, so you have a propane thing outside, you may have weapons, ammunition inside your home, whatever you have.
I see.
So now if I provide that to the Chinese or to the Russians or anybody who does not have our best interest at heart, they know exactly where do I go to find where they're storing ammunition. So if you want to reverse engineer the arcs, you could do that. That's why we don't provide that sort of information to the public.
Well, but sort of general information, though, about, I mean, I understand you're so saying specifically, yeah. You know, X marks the spot, here's where, like, the highest explosives are stored. I mean, I can see why you wouldn't want to get that information out. But in terms of the blast zone, you know, like, from a worst-case scenario.
The only thing we'll put out is the arcs are managed so that nobody is within the arc. So the surrounding community cannot be within a blast arc. So that's the only thing that we would tell Port Townsend people is what you should know is that you're not there. So you're not inside the arc. Doesn't mean that zero damage will happen
Port Townsend or other structures. So with any explosion, you're going to have a shockwave that goes away from that source and is going to go outward. So could there be a broken window? That's possible. Are they going to have fragmentation and major damage in Port Townsend? Unlikely, almost 0% chance of that.
So maybe discuss our safety record since 1941.
It's an easy discussion because a total of zero. So we have a total
zero
of
accidents.
Zero accidents since 1941. So never in the history of this, somebody should knock on wood for me. So never in the history of this station have we had a significant accident, no. So we got a good history.
What do you think is, if there is a weak link in the security here of explosives somehow going off, what would it be?
Honestly, there is no weak link. This isn't old school TNT, so it's not like there's a stick of dynamite and it readily goes off. To set today's munitions off, you have to willfully make that happen. So you can't drop something. I've watched airplanes crash on the back of the ship, fully loaded. They'll hit the ramp of the ship, burst into flames. You'll see the ordnance come off the jet, and it'll cycle down the flight deck because it's still moving at 140 miles an hour off the ship or even in a fire, and we'll put that stuff out, and the ordnance is okay. Same thing out with accidents I've seen in the desert. When you recover the airplane, the ordnance is all still intact. It does not explode unless you've told it to do so. It has to be fused. It has to be all the triggering mechanisms have to be in place.
Can I ask you one thing?
Yeah.
For years, there was a concern about depleted uranium on warheads or bomb heads and so on that may have been either stored here, transported from here or to here, and through the communities from wherever they're manufactured. Mm-hmm. And for years, there was a concern about the trucks not being placarded and so on. And I think finally that was resolved in the... What's the possibility that there is depleted uranium munitions on this facility?
I don't have any indication of any of those sort of weapons on this base. So, and I don't honestly, like I said before, I'd have to look at the dates. I don't remember the last time, but it's been several years since we've ever had anything like that.
Maybe still using that type of munition, you know?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, no.
It's still out there, I suspect.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Even in the Army circles, I don't know.
One guy I can't speak for Army. Okay.
Would you be able to say anything about what is the importance of Indian Island in its geographical location? I mean, why is this site an important site?
I don't want to throw Seal Beach under the rug. So if you compare us to some other installations, they are surrounded by a community. Literally, the community goes up to the fence line, and they still manage their arcs. Like I said before, you never cast an arc into a area where the public is at. So the water, having a peninsula, if you want to call it a peninsula or an island, having an island like this where we have water on all sides of us, it's a natural buffer so that we can maintain a safe distance from the community. So it's huge. Beyond that piece, we have a deep water port, which is honestly why Port Townsend exists today, because 100 years ago, 140 years ago, 1890s, you know what I mean? That was supposed to be what Port Townsend was going to be. It was a major port because of the deep water here. So deep water, no bridges, easy access to the Pacific, and the fleets here. So all those reasons make us extremely strategic for the West Coast.
Do you work with the local Department of Emergency Management and do any drills with them? Or?
We do. So most of those are, so we work with Jefferson County Sheriff. We kind of roll it all into one. So we'll do a scenario. The last one we did was active shooter drill. So what we do is we'll work with the community to include the Jefferson Memorial Hospital. Is that what they're called? The up in Port Townsend. So we'll bring them on board. We'll work with the local fire ambulances. So that scenario, we had our cops responded, the sheriff responded, highway patrol responded to eliminate the active shooter. And then we worked with the ambulances and stuff, and we brought in our own casualties. So we had, what did we have? I think it was like 20 guys that were our injured personnel. They brought them all, and they activated a triage site off-site from the hospital.
so we could get these guys to an offsite facility. Yeah, drills all the time for earthquake preparedness. A lot of those are more centered in the, I have my own emergency operations center, so I'm connected to the entire Navy. We don't really connect with JEFCO that much as far as a, because there's some problems there as far as DISCA goes, Defense Support to Civil Authorities. So I got to be careful how much we interact at the onset of an emergency until the governor has asked permission from the president to use or be able to work with military entities. But we meet with Bob Hamlin. I think he left, actually.
Yeah, he's
but,
gone now.
Yeah, and I haven't met the new person yet, so I still got to get over there.
She just started a couple weeks ago.
So she'll get around.
You might have already said this on the bus, but I couldn't hear what you were saying. Did you say that there are no nuclear weapons here, or that it's something you can't talk about?
Yeah, it's something I can't talk about. Yeah. So we can never talk about where those things are. Only thing I can tell you is evaluate. If you want to take your best guess, you can take a look at who my customers are. You can take a look at the fact that you're here. Those things tell a story, but I can't specifically say.
A Banger was a base specifically created for nuclear submarines.
Mm-hmm. Right. With nuclear weapons on board, yeah.
But the Navy will neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah. No, we don't. That's the way it goes. Right. Or the Air Force or the Army. Nobody has that ability.
Well, can you explain the confirm or deny policy statement? Is that just because, is that a security thing?
Safe to say that, the role of federal government is to keep America safe. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing that for well plus 200 years. Mm-hmm. And we plan to continue doing just that.
But confirming or denying whether or not there's nuclear weapons, how does that help us?
It's just more for the safety of the community. In other words, you know what I mean? You don't share your best kept secrets with everyone.
Well, it's safe to say that what we might tell you, others might be interested in.
I see.
And not everybody is America's friend.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody loves America. We love America, you love America, but not everybody loves America, you know. And obviously these kinds of decisions are made at levels of government well beyond our pay grade, as it were. Why don't we get on the bus and continue?
Yeah.
The tour continued for about 3 hours, and we learned many things. We learned that when Vancouver's Discovery Expedition arrived at the location of today's munitions loading dock with its giant no trespassing signs, the now extinct Chimicum tribe had similar signs in the form of human heads on stakes for their fishing camp right there, and that the location held the same strategic value for the Indians who gave the island its name as it does today for the U.S. Navy. We learned that today's Indians retain and exercise their fishing rights on the island. We learned that the installation of the giant blue container-loading crane visible from miles around was a career crusher for the first engineer who attempted it and failed. And thanks to the departure of the island's fire department to deal with that civilian emergency off-island and the resulting suspension of weapons loading, we were allowed to drive right out on the munitions loading pier across steel grating designed to allow daylight to pass through and nurture eelgrass and fish fry, and then continue past countless ammo containers and stacks of artillery shells and other lethal contrivances in the shadow of that crane and of a multi-story munitions transport ship, staffed, we learned, not by active-duty Navy sailors, but mostly by civilians, albeit mostly retired Navy civilians. We learned that those civilians rarely come into any home port, but spend about three-quarters of the year at sea and in foreign ports. And for those of us who might worry that the countless bullets, bombs, and missiles represented by those countless ammo cases on the wharf and in the many magazines we passed might meet their mark and shatter lives and families, there were these words of reassurance from the commander of Indian Island.
So about 40,000 tons per year is moved either onto or off of ships. Now remember, this isn't all, when we put stuff on a ship, it doesn't go forward and get used. This is stuff that's coming back and forth. So some weapons do get used, but the bulk of that material will all end up back here. So something will get on a carrier from us, 6 to 8 months, that all that material will return and we'll put it back in storage.
On tour at Naval Magazine Indian Island, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.